Sunday Evangelium with Father Andrew Pinsent on the first Sunday of Lent.
When teaching ethics to undergraduates some years ago, I conducted an anonymous survey at the beginning of the course to discover their views on various moral dilemmas. The answers were revealing in many ways. For example, sometimes the same question phrased in different language would elicit a different response. An important consideration in addressing issues like abortion or euthanasia. It was also revealing that there were at least some moral absolutes among the entire group. Almost all of them thought that adultery was wrong, and almost all of them claimed that even if no one found out, it will be wrong to cheat in an exam. At least, that is what they told me. The answer that was most disturbing to me, however, was the large majority of students who thought that lying was acceptable, at least in certain circumstances. In the Old and New Testaments, lying is a grave matter. And the eighth commandment of the Decalogue prohibits bearing false witness against one's neighbor. In today's first reading, the serpent uses lies in order to tempt Eve in the Garden of Eden. And Jesus describes the devil as the father of lies. As a consequence, the prohibition of lying has been an integral part of Jewish and Christian traditions. In Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, St. Thomas More attempts to defend his life by silence and by equivocation, but he never tells a lie. In recent centuries, however, this prohibition has weakened to the point of vanishing. Martin Luther notoriously advised Philip of Hesse that a good, strong lie, one that is useful or helpful, would be acceptable to God. And Friedrich Nietzsche suggested that the falseness of a judgment is not necessarily an objection, claiming that what is untrue is a condition of life. In today's society, the trend towards the acceptability of the untrue has accelerated to the point that lying is discussed mainly as a pragmatic issue, not as a moral issue. It seems that words, whether such words are true or false, are treated simply as a tool. If the truth will serve, then truth is spoken. But equally, if falsehood will serve, then lies are spoken, provided, of course, that the goal of the speaker is achieved. The implicit standard often followed today is that the end justifies the means. How then is it possible to argue against the end justifying the means? After all, in today's first reading, the fruit of the tree was good to eat and pleasing to the eye. So why not reach out and taste it? Similarly, in today's account of the temptation of Christ, why not command stones to turn into bread? For food is surely something good, especially when a person is hungry. Why not show the truth of the gospel quickly by some great public spectacle? Why not accept all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor by a simple and direct route, requiring just one act of false worship? When the end is self-evidently good, why not compromise just a little on the means? Perhaps the clearest and easiest response from everyday life is in the form of a counter-challenge. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who betrays you by disobeying you and doing evil, even if the end is supposedly good? Is it possible to be friends with someone who lies about some grave matter? A liar is someone whose words and thoughts do not correspond, so that what the person says cannot be trusted. At a deeper level, the thoughts of habitual liars are often divided, so that they sometimes believe their own lies. In this condition, it is almost as if there is no one to relate to, because the person's soul is divided against itself. This divided state is like that of the souls in Dante's Inferno, souls who both receive what they desire and hate what they receive. And it is the opposite of the condition of the saints, who are in harmony through loving perfectly with God the things that God loves. The division caused by lies and betrayal, a condition within oneself and between oneself and God, is one reason why God provides the gift of confession, since confession enables an admission of the truth, a reintegration of one's soul, and a reconciliation with God. A second and final response to the pragmatic challenge is on its own terms, namely that there is a sting in the tail for those who only see the end without considering the means. Adam and Eve do not need to taste the fruit to be like God or to know good and evil, for they are already made in the image and likeness of God and know what they should and should not do. Similarly, in today's gospel, Jesus does not need to accept the kingdoms of the world from the devil's hand, because he already has them in his own hand. All that the devil tempts with is not a false means to a true end, the temptation of pragmatism, but a false means to a false end, an ending that is in death and not in life. So may God help us to recognize and resist false promises of happiness, to keep integrity and friendship with him, and to come safely one day into the true and lasting happiness of heaven.